Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Are you watching the Olympics? Because if you are, you're the only one. 33-year low in terms of the viewership of the Olympics. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. I haven't been very much, Amy. Did the dude in that women's weightlift from New Zealand, that women's weightlifting competition, did he go yet?
He hasn't competed yet. Shim has not competed yet. But you didn't watch the opening ceremonies? Because first time in my entire life, I did not watch the opening ceremonies. And I caught some skateboarding, some swimming, girls beach volleyball, and that's about it. But I'm normally glued to the television during the Olympics. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I'm not into it. I think it's mostly because there's not fans. And that bothers me. And then as a parent, can you imagine your child finally going to the Olympics and you can't be there in person to watch? Come on.
Can you imagine your child growing up to be an NBA star and going to the Olympics and losing to France? I can't. I can't. I don't know what that pain must feel like.
Who saw that coming? What odds makers in Vegas made some money off of
that? I don't
know.
After they lost the exhibitions to other underdeveloped nations, and I include France in that category, it was foreshadowing. How bad is the NBA product?
How bad is it?
Well, they lost to France. That's how bad it is.
But, and by the way, didn't we get it together if they didn't practice too much?
Didn't we get shut out in the medals in the first day?
Yes, for the first time since, what, 19... What year was it?
I can't remember.
But yeah,
you're
we
the Olympic
shut
correspondent.
We were shut out for medals the first day.
Yeah, but no, we've rallied back. Now we lead in the gold.
Right.
Yeah, we're just a little bit.
But the medal
total,
count, were...
We're one behind China in the total, but we've got the most gold, which is all that matters because the only medal that counts is gold. Nate and Schiller Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I just wanted to make one quick comment. Mm-hmm. I'm not watching it like I usually do because that, whatever you want to call her, who disgraced my flag, they didn't kick her off. They still allowed her to go. I will not support anything that disgraces my flag and people do nothing about it. Thanks for my comment. You guys have a great day.
Thanks for the call, Nate.
A first time since 1972, that we were shut out of medals on the first day of the Olympics.
Maybe after the U.S. women's soccer team got a bit of a comeuppance when they got blanked.
By Sweden, thank you.
And people were responding positively to Sweden defeating Team USA. I'm talking about USA Americans as well as USA soccer fans. Maybe that chastened the WNBA players. Who chose not to protest after they were planning on protesting, similar to that Gwen Berry that Nate from Schiller Park was referring to. You know, and it's shocking too because Jill Biden has brought her star power to the Olympics to salvage it. White House COVID team, Dr. Biden, not a doctor, will be among the select dignitaries and VIPs in the stands at Olympic Stadium on Friday for the opening ceremony. She's following strict protocols, of course, and. Vogue magazine would just, you know, vomit it all over themselves. The Olympics could likely use a dose of Jill Biden, herself a marathon runner, after a rash of demoralizing PR. Yeah, you know, that's what you really... Jill Biden. I'm surprised that her charisma wasn't able to pull people back to their TV sets after some of these disgraceful exhibitions like Nate from Schiller Park was referring to, as well as disgraceful performances like Team USA losing to France. I can't get over that.
One good thing, though, the flag bearer, he's extremely grateful. His name is Eddie Alvarez, because I know you didn't watch it, but he carried the flag into this ceremony with no fans. But he was so happy and proud to be an American.
Means...
So when he found out.
Everything to me. It's, again, I owe so much to my parents, to my family. I came over to this country, so to be able to lead Team USA is an absolute honor. There's a lot of sacrifice I've had to make in this life, my athletic career. So just absolutely incredibly honored, and what a privilege.
See, that was one person who appreciated it.
No, there's definitely, it's a mixed bag. There's no question. And by the way, as an aside, did you see that the triathlon?
I watched that. The guy from Norway.
Well, yeah, but where
he's
they
awesome.
Yeah, I know you're obsessed with Scandinavia, but the the boat.
What boat?
The boat that steered in front of them as they were about to dive in the water.
No, I didn't. I saw
bizarre.
The bike in the run part of the triathlon.
Well, with respect to the mixed bag, in terms of some of the reaction here back at home to Team USA, our friends over at Campus Reform, they went out to South Florida University, did a little MOS on campus.
Do people even know what the Olympics are?
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
South Florida Bulls, and emphasis on bull. Here's two in particular that are telling. Remember, these are, you know, at some point likely to be college graduates.
I think it's embarrassing that, you know, our own athletes who are on Team USA aren't even proud to be an American, it seems like.
I don't think so, because I don't like being an American either, even though I'm born here. I think there is such corruption and a crumbling infrastructure. Like, why is there no free health care? Why are so many people suffering because of housing? And that is such a great example of how corrupt it is here.
Do you think athletes should be allowed to express their political beliefs or protest during the Olympics?
I believe so. Either way, no matter what they do, the Olympics or anything is going to be used for politics, because even if, let's say, the U.S. wins or any other country, that country is going to use their win to show that our country is the best and whatnot.
Do you think the United States is the greatest country?
Look at me. No, I don't.
Look at me. He's black. No, I don't. Right. Well, where would you like to go? Where would you prefer to be? Where is it better for someone, look at me, like you, than the United States of America? And that was sort of the point that Herschel Walker made, too. I don't, these people that go and want to disgrace the flag, want to run down America, I mean, if you don't like it,
leave.
It's basically as simple as that.
I started appreciating America so much more when I lived in a foreign country for 6 months. I mean, I couldn't get back here fast enough. And I've always been proud to be an American, but you really appreciate what you have when you live somewhere else. So those kids should go on a sabbatical, so to speak. Why don't they go to Haiti for a week? See how life is.
Well, they were asked those same two, and among others. And again, there were some that were supportive of Team USA, some that were just generally confused, even more so than these two. They were asked, are you going to root for Team USA?
You're going to be rooting for Team USA?
I don't root for countries. I root for athletes.
Will you be rooting for Team USA?
I'm going to be rooting for athletes individually. I'm not going to be rooting for any team just because it's some country that I live in, because the truth is patriotism shouldn't be that strong. I'm in this country because I was born in it and because it gives me some opportunities. It doesn't mean that there aren't things to fix, so I'm not going to root on someone just because they come from the same place as me. I'm not proud to live in a country where I can't even go down my own neighborhood and see people putting up their Blue Lives Matter flags telling me that my life doesn't matter.
I root for particular athletes rather than the country as a whole.
Yeah, me too. That's why I'm not rooting for Megan Rapinoe and the women's soccer team. How's that?
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the justice system in America. Radicalized by the FBI. Perhaps this group of would-be assassins that targeted the Ava Perón of East Lansing, Gretchen Whitmer. Now the story is coming out. More than a dozen undercover agents, informants, well, not undercover agents, I should be specific. The FBI had at least a dozen informants heavily involved in the Watchmen. This is this group that supposedly plotted to take out Gretchen Whitmer, allegedly did. And in addition to that, FBI agents took an active part in the scheme from its inception, according to court filings, evidence, dozens of interviews examined by BuzzFeed, for who reported on this over the weekend. Some of the members of the Wolverine Watchmen are accusing the feds of entrapment. One FBI informant from Wisconsin allegedly helped organize meetings where the first inklings of the Whitmer plot surfaced, even paying for hotel rooms and food to entice people to attend. This Iraqi war veteran, identified as Dan by BuzzFeed, allegedly shelled out for transportation costs to militia meetings and apparently goaded members to advance the plot. Again, court filings.
Is anybody surprised by this?
I don't know. Are you?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
One of the attorneys for one of the 14 individuals arrested, a man named Kareem Johnson, who's described as black, left-wing attorney. The FBI knew these people had some beliefs and were egging them on and providing help and ammunition.
Oh.
They encouraged, helped instigate, and escalated the criminal conduct of those individuals. At the end of the day, there were almost as many FBI agents leading the group as other people in the group. If you haven't read it, it's amazing because there is no dystopian novel that is not coming true these days. And one of the best and underappreciated from the 20th century was The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton. And it's about Scotland Yard recruiting poets, in this case, it's sort of to infiltrate an anarchist group. And, you know, think about when this book was written at the turn of the 20th century. This was when, you know, anarchist groups were like a real deal. It wasn't like sloganeering and, you know, sit-ins on college campuses. They were advocating and employing violence, much like we see today. So it's just amazing the parallels between this. And it's really the whole plot of The Man Who Was Thursday is this chaos versus order tension in a free society. And when law enforcement becomes part of instigating the chaos, part of perpetuating the chaos, which we may have in this case of Gretchen Whitmer. It's remarkable, by the way, that Iraqi war veteran.
Yeah, from Wisconsin.
Yeah, he was arrested.
For what?
Beating his wife. His name is Richard Trask of Kalamazoo, Iraqi war veteran. He is accused of repeatedly slamming his wife's head into a nightstand and choking her with both hands before she stopped the attack by grabbing his crotch, according to a report by the Detroit News, citing a court affidavit. His wife's chest, clothes, and hands were covered in blood. She had severe bruises around her neck, according to the affidavit. The two had come home after attending a hotel event, a local hotel event. The publication called it a swingers party. After some drinks, they argued on the way home about how Trask's wife didn't enjoy the party, and apparently the violence ensued then. I guess that was the monthly Lisa Page, Peter Strzok key party up there in Kalamazoo. I don't know. Or near Kalamazoo. So, I mean, you know, we're supposed to do this. The senior leadership of the FBI is separate and distinct from the rank and file. And again, the FBI is a big organization. So, you know, you're going to have some problematic agents, I presume, in the rank and file ranks. But this whole culture at FBI, I mean, there's too many high profile incidents to just look past it aren't there? Involved in a plot to assassinate a sitting governor that they, again, allegedly, this is all to be adjudicated,
right,
that they had a material part in advancing. It's one thing to infiltrate and monitor and stop.
Right.
It's another thing to push and then stop.
Right. And they wanted to, remember, kidnap her first and bring her to the Capitol and hold her on trial for treason. It was such a goofy, weird, unbelievable plot. I don't know. And I'm looking at a picture of this guy. Have you seen a picture of him? Richard Trask?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Oof.
John in Portage Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. I'd just like to remind everybody that in 1968, the Days of Rage and all that with the weathermen and stuff in Chicago with the, you know, Democratic Convention, that 1 out of 10 of the rioters were either Chicago police or FBI. It was found out. It's just a fact. And it's not the first time that they've done this. You know, it's, and they were the loudest ones shouting, too. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, John. I don't know. I've never heard that 10% stat about police and FBI in Chicago. This was ununiformed police officers in addition to FBI agents but acting as agitators. I don't know. But, I mean, it does harken back to the weathermen, that's for sure. This is just a remarkable thing, though.
He's out on bond, by the way.
This is a remarkable thing. If what the legal representatives of these guys arrested in this plot are saying turns out to be true. Again, it's one thing if you're infiltrating like Donnie Brasco and there actually is a mob operation that you're infiltrating to take down at some point. And then it's a judgment call, too, because these informants become participants in criminal activity and it can get a little dicey. But that's a going thing. If this wasn't a going thing and they pushed and pushed and pushed to make it a going thing, I mean, beyond even that being the definition of entrapment, what exactly is the posture of the FBI with respect to the citizenry it serves?
Anybody trust them anymore? Because I don't. Jeez.
Steve in Willowbrook.
Hey, good morning, guys. I remember reading as a kid that forever two clowns.
Hey, Steve, can you talk into the phone? We can't hear you.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
I remember reading that for every two Klansmen years ago, one was an FBI agent or informant.
Okay.
Do you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. All right.
That was just my point that, you know, this has not just been going on recently. It's been going on for a long time.
Well, thanks for the call, Steve. But the difference is, again, not infiltration, law enforcement operation. That's one thing. Criminal organization, the outfit, the Klan. Okay. Sure. It's aiding and abetting. That's different. You know, if the FBI had infiltrated the Klan and an FBI agent participated in a lynching, then we have a problem. Or suggested a lynching. Or said, let's go. You know, I mean, that's right. What we're talking about here.
But if they, you know, like promoted it and scheduled it, then that's wrong. Then they should be charged. I mean, they're inviting people over to meetings and providing food and give them the idea, like, hey, let's try and do this. I mean, that's some big stuff. And the fact that he got arrested 1 week after that information was disclosed in court is going to give the defense more ammunition.
I remember when unmasking was something we were supposed to care about. This is something that's a significant concern. And by the way, did we ever get any resolution in terms of who unmasked Carter Page, who unmasked General Michael Flynn?
No.
In the Obama administration? I wonder if we'll ever get any information about who unmasked Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, remember, at the end of last month, made this claim that per somebody in NSA, National Security Agency, they were reading his email. And it seemed to and this guy repeated back to Tucker Carlson things that you could have only known if you were reading his emails, according to Tucker. And it would involve Tucker Carlson, apparently now we know it involved Tucker Carlson and his show trying to get an interview with Vlad Putin, which other networks have had interviews with Vlad Putin. So this is not exactly this is not problematic in any way on its face. And so now we understand that the Tucker Carlson's communications, not a target of the NSA, they were instantly collected through the process of spying on a foreign target. The report said Carlson's identity was instead disclosed through a process known as unmasking. Right. U.S. citizens that are mentioned but covered up in authorized covered up in final intelligence reports about the surveillance of foreigners, they can be revealed upon request of authorized officials who have the ability to ask for disclosures, often to understand the information, the intel better, so they have context. Okay, fine. Well, so who did it? And what was the context? I mean, we have a foreign target, so I can't tell you too much. Well, tell us enough to understand why Tucker Carlson's name was unmasked. We don't know. We don't get answers. We still don't have answers from the Russian collusion farce about unmasking or just about anything else. Oh, by the way, the Durham report.
Yeah, how's that thing? The what report?
Likely to be made public, according to a deputy assistant attorney general.
When?
Don't know. Likely to be made public if it's ever completed. So we have that to look forward to. I'm sure there'll be answers to these and many other questions. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. This is what Senator John Edwards in North Carolina evidently was referring to when he said there were two Americas. There's one system of justice for the left and one for conservatives. That's the way it is. And, you know, these agencies are weaponized by the left whenever they get into power, and even when they're not in power, weaponized against conservatives. It's really disgusting that this is part of our republic or former republic.
Thanks for the call, Frank. And by the way, it demands that, unfortunately, we treat these agencies, or we look at these agencies with a jaundiced eye. We treat them with a healthy level of skepticism. We ask questions and demand answers. We don't default to, well, you know, you're a federal law enforcement officer, so I know you're doing the right thing. I'm sorry, whether this is fair or not, it becomes difficult to say you're doing the right thing when you see repeated examples of what Frank is talking about. And we're not just talking about FBI, of course. We're talking about intelligence agencies. We're talking about the IRS. Craig in Lowell, Indiana.
Yeah, Dan, you made the comment that this isn't necessarily the rank and file. Why should they be trusted? I don't ever hear of any whistleblower come out in any of these agencies saying what all the stuff that they're doing wrong and the laws that they're breaking. They're all in on it together. Why should they be trusted over the hierarchy?
Thanks for the call, Craig.
Well, is the FBI politicized so much that they want Republicans to look bad, that they convince these bunch of clowns to go and try and make a plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer? I mean, come on.
You know, it's interesting, too, just going back to Frank's point about the two systems of justice. Tom Barrack, who's a businessman, friend of Trump's, who was his inaugural committee chairman.
Oh, yeah.
He was charged with violating federal lobbying law with respect to disclosure and failing to disclose his work on behalf of the United Arab Emirates. $250 million bond.
What?
Yeah. $250 million bond because they want to rein in foreign lobbying practices. I mean, unless your name's Hunter Biden.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, quickly, Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, this is the same kind of thing that why people don't want to believe the government about vaccinations. If they could just have a little bit of virtue and wanting to do what's right for the American people, we might have a little more faith in them.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Marvin. Is that too much to ask? Apparently, at present, it is.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Time of the morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, there was a peace march in North Lawndale on Friday.
And then what happened hours later, Dan?
Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown was there. Now violent offenders are on their heels, worrying if any of these people are going to tell on them. Is that right? Father Larry Dowling, St. Agatha. Our main focus is not to go out and condemn, but to really try to say, we're here for you. We want to offer you an alternative. Uh-huh. Yeah. And after that peace march on Friday, 69 people were shot and 10 were murdered over the weekend.
In that same neighborhood. There were 5 were shot in that same neighborhood that David Brown walked the streets of a few hours later.
So I guess those violent offenders were not worrying? Huh.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Pastor Phil Jackson, no relation, founder and CEO of Firehouse Community Arts Center, said the Peace Walk is an opportunity for the community to embrace the neighborhood's youth in a different way in an effort to break the cycle of violence. You know, that all sounds lovely, that flowery language, and that, you know, optimistic, we're coming together to take on the bad actors in the neighborhood. But it's just like, it's just empty rhetoric. It's almost parody at this point. 100 kids under the age of 15 have been shot in Chicago this year. Maybe you should ask Lori Lightfoot, is it worse for a teenager to get COVID or to get shot? Because we have a lot more kids who got shot than we do kids that got sick from COVID.
Yeah. 3 have died from COVID.
Uh-huh.
And we've had, I think, I don't even know how many have died of those 100 kids shot. I thought it was 201 were shot. 18 and younger, but 15 and younger, yes, 100 kids.
Getting,
100 kids.
Getting a little bit more brazen, too, by the way. You're not safe in the hospital. Gunmen opened fire outside of Mount Sinai on the west side, bullets smashing through 3 windows. I mean, we know this. I mean, when you have gangbangers that come into these hospitals shot, you got to have police presence there so that other gangbangers don't follow them in. When you have gangbangers that are shot on the streets, you have to have police presence on the perimeter of the scene because other gangbangers show up to potentially escalate.
Yeah, they want revenge.
D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti, we haven't heard from him before, but we're going to hear from him now. He's a black gentleman. He had this to say at a presser that he had at the end of last week after shootings in D.C. Listen to what he says about D.C. See if it reminds you of any other place.
Officers, our officers assigned here in the 3rd District, they recovered a firearm off an individual down here at 11th and S, Vermont. Right before that, a firearm right up here, 14th and Irving Street. After the sounds of gunshots, right up there. When this shooting happened, officers, within 5 seconds of the shooting where it happened, that's unacceptable. It speaks to the brazenness of the criminals that are in these communities that we're dealing with. Some of them are our neighbors, some are. And we have to really figure out what do we want to do as a city in terms of how we respond to this. We can take the political route and talk, you know, all of this fluffy stuff. But I'm going to give it to you straight where the issues are. And where the issues are, the ecosystem, the justice system that we have right now, it is not functioning the way that it should. The courts are not open. That is a fact. Barely open. So cases from last year, from 2020 that happened during COVID, of violent criminals that have not been disposed of, what do you think those individuals are? Anybody want to take a guess? They're in community. They're in community, and their cases have not been disposed of. We have to look at, are the things happening that needs to happen when we do place individuals under arrest? The guy for carrying the gun there, the guy for carrying the gun there. What happens with that case when it goes through the system? What's the outcome? What is the expected outcome? What does the community expect when a person gets caught with a firearm? What do we expect? Do we expect to see them in a neighborhood in 3 weeks? And if we do, are we saying that that's acceptable? Because most of the communities that I've talked to have no clue what happens with these cases. They don't. But I'm going to tell you the truth. The real issue is we have a vicious cycle of bad actors who do things, no accountability, and they end up back in community. And the police officers, and I guarantee you, when we lock up whoever did this, they will be no stranger to us. I promise you that. So I want us to make sure that we are reclaiming this community.
Mm-hmm. I guess he's a white supremacist. Robert Conte, police chief in D.C. Is that what I should understand? With his unvarnished talk about what's happening in that city and where some responsibility lies. The one question he asked, I think, is the operative question. Doesn't really get asked that much. It doesn't really get discussed, actually, that much, considering how much time is devoted to this topic. What do you want your community to be like? You know, this North Lawndale resident, Lakina Young, saying, my heart is heavy because I have children, I have grandchildren, so my thing is I want peace. Okay, well, what are you willing to do for it? You don't have it, no, so what are you willing to do to get it? Father Dowling, again from St. Agatha, our main focus is to not go out and condemn, but to say we're here for you. We want to offer you an alternative. Is that the approach? I mean, I appreciate, the sort of hat tip to Christian mercy, but is that really the approach? Is that the message to send? We're not here to condemn. We're not here to make judgment calls. You're not? Maybe that's how we got here, because people weren't willing to make judgment calls. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 646-36-DA, turnkey.protextline.
Is it time to hug it out yet? Remember, Mayor Lightfoot said it's time to love these people who are wreaking havoc on our city. Yeah.
Is that the issue? Or is it time to tough love some of these people?
Well, the good news is today St. Sabina is doing a gun buyback program for, I think, the 1,000th time. I remember covering that in 1996. $200, Dan, for a handgun or assault rifle.
Yeah, right.
$100 for rifles and $20 for high-capacity magazines.
Yeah.
Anyone 25 or younger.
Peace marches and gun buybacks and
midnight basketball.
Empty rhetoric, empty tough talk from police chief politicians. I mean, it's exactly what that D.C. police chief Conte said, which is fluffy. Fluffy, fluffy, fluffy. How's fluffy working?
Also, these, you know, work programs. I think gangbangers are not interested in joining the summer work programs.
Oh, really? Midnight basketball?
Yeah,
anybody?
I don't think they're into that either.
Arts and crafts at the local community center. Is that what we're missing? There's not enough after-school programs. Is that right? And summer programs. Not enough programs generally. Here's a thought. How about holding those kids responsible and their families responsible for what happens, like the parent or guardian? And I mean that culturally, not legally. The individual assailant, I mean legally as well, of course. But my point is to say, you know, we're not here to condemn. Actually, I think we need to be. Actually, the fluffy talk doesn't work. We're here to show them an alternative. They're aware of the alternatives.
Yeah, they know. They're not stupid. They just don't want to do the alternatives.
And where are the adults here? And for those adults in the peace march, what do you have to say about your neighbors? Are you willing to call out your neighbors? Are you willing to say something about Johnny's mom and or dad and or grandparent next door? And what the hell is Johnny doing? And why are you allowing Johnny to do it? I mean, there's no easy answer to any of this. There's no light switch that can be flipped. But to expect the police, politicians, to intervene where the family has failed and where the family has failed sort of institutionally in some of these neighborhoods is just a futile effort. And I guess if you don't level with people and say, unless you do your job, it is impossible for us to do ours. In other words, unless you control your household, it is impossible for us to control the streets and make them safe for people. Give Miss Young in North Lawndale the peace that she wants. We can't do it if you don't do it. This is not, you know, we indulge anything and everything in the home, in the school, and then police are supposed to come and clean up the mess that inevitably ensues. There's no chance. Zero chance. It will not happen. And so you have peace marches and gun buybacks and press conferences and crocodile tears because they know this to be true. So what do? They're just protecting their own hide by appearing to do something, appearing to care. If you cared about somebody, you tell them the truth. And the politicians and the politician cops and the media in this city do not care about people because they're unwilling to tell them the truth. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, every week we listen to this, and then it would have brought to life when one of your caller's nephews was killed. But I think what they're trying to do is just let them kill each other because they're solving the crimes. You never mention when these people are shot what the actual shot is. You know, was it in the arm, in the face, whatever. You never tell that damage. And until the crime actually hits the North Shore, Michigan Avenue, where the lily white people, where Amy lives and everything, until it hits there, you're not going to see any change because no one cares about, not like what's going on the west side there and the south side where the mass shootings are. You're always going to get a crime somewhere. Even in Oak Brook, they have a crime once in a while. But I'm just saying until it hits those areas, you're not going to see much change because they're actually solving the crimes. I wish you guys would get a detective on there and see what they actually do when they go to a crime scene. I bet it's just take the pictures and the photos. They never see anybody in court because probably the preps that actually shot or probably shot the following week. Have a nice day.
All right, Ed. Well, yeah, I mean, it's some combination of that. I don't know. It's not about it's still about clearing cases, even if somebody does a shooting and then they're a victim of a shooting later on. It's still about clearing cases, and the clearance rate is under 20%, or was last year. And for the last few, as far as I can recall, there's been 137 expressway shootings in Chicago so far this year. Oh, and that's despite, $13 million in federal funny money to tighten up the streets in Chicago. All the money, all the rhetoric, and here we are. 100 kids under 15 shot, 137 expressway shootings. I mean, you know, the expressway is... pretty small D democratic, isn't it? That's, the full expanse of humanity. I don't know if you've been involved or seen an expressway shooting. Does that send a bit of a chill down your spine if you're driving out 290 or 88 to get back to Oak Brook? It's just, people just will not level and say if you allow a child to run wild, and you institutionalize that as the culture in a particular neighborhood, particular school, this is what you're going to get. And until you condemn and you shame adults and kids alike for their conduct or the lack of discipline, both individually and institutionally in a family setting, what do you think is going to change? You think it's one more program? It's one more beat cop? There's no chance.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Second of the call quickly. Sarah in Glenview, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hi there. My comment is there should be, follow the money, there should be financial consequences. Why should welfare payments continue to families of gangbangers?
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Sarah. Scott in Hanover Park.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for getting the blood pressure going. I appreciate that. Two folds to this. Yes, it starts with the family. And as long as a couple generations ago, and he's not necessarily a popular guy, Bill Cosby was telling the black community about this. There has to be a nuclear family. There needs to be a father at home to help with discipline. The second side is, at day's end, our criminal justice system is not that. It's a revolving door. And like it or not, there is no physical, visual, I am being retained, detained consequence for anything anybody does. So I think there's a lot of blame to go around, and families in the community need to start going to Kim Fox's office and demanding she do her job or resign. And it goes around. I mean, the mayor's not any better. All these policies about no bail, and we're just going to let you out and do an electronic monitoring. Please, guys, tell me how that's really helping to detour crime.
Well,
I'd like to know.
Thanks, well, Scott.
Over the weekend, the 31st person, listen to this, a man on bond for felony gun case, he shot two people in two separate robberies an hour apart. He's the 31st person charged with shooting, killing, or trying to kill someone in Chicago this year while on felony bond. And people are keeping track. CWB, of course, is keeping track of all of that.
And where, you know, and
31st.
So these pastors and these community activists and stuff, they're not afraid to wade into politics. Where are they to say, not just the family piece, where are they to say that your elected officials for generations have failed you and it's time to think completely differently about the kind of representation we have at the city and county level? Where's the anybody saying that, maybe with the exception of Corey Brooks?
AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, our friend and brother in sound, as you say, Amy, Larry Elder, the sage of South Central, he's not only running for governor of California, he's also running for induction into the Radio Hall of Fame.
Oh, good.
So if you're here in Illinois, for example, or Indiana, or Wisconsin, can't vote for him for governor, you can vote for him to join the Radio Hall of Fame. Go online to radiovote.com, radiovote.com, and vote to put Larry Elder into the Radio Hall of Fame where he belongs.
Yeah, he does. He belongs governor, too. He's actually leading a poll, beating out John Cox and Caitlyn Jenner right now.
Well, yeah, he's leading
among the brother, other challengers.
Yeah, but which is great, and that'll advance an intelligent discussion for the next month and a half until the California recall election, but it's going to be a heavy lift to get rid of Newsom.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and our generations, Rowan and Martin, that would be Tony Fauci and Jake Tapper, were on to do their routine Sunday as per usual. This time the topic was the CDC confabbing about reimposing mask promotion, mask guidance, saying wear masks.
Even if you're vaccinated, though.
And this is what Tony Fauci had to say in that exchange.
Sources are telling CNN the top health officials are weighing whether to revise mask guidelines for vaccinated Americans. Are you part of those conversations? And if so, what are you advising? Do you think masks should be brought back for vaccinated Americans?
You know, Jake, this is under active consideration. If you're asking, am I part of the discussion? Yes, I am part of the discussion. But I think what you are seeing, even though as of our conversation at this moment, the CDC still says and recommends that if you are vaccinated fully, that you do not need to wear a mask indoors. However, if you look at what's going on locally in the trenches in places like LA County, the local officials have the discretion, and the CDC agrees with that ability and discretion capability to say, you know, you're in a situation where we're having a lot of dynamics of infection. So even if you are vaccinated, you should wear a mask. That's a local decision that's not incompatible with the CDC's overall recommendations that give a lot of discretion to the locals. And we're seeing that in L.A. We're seeing it in Chicago. We're seeing that in New Orleans, because the officials there, many of them are saying, even if you're vaccinated, it's prudent to wear a mask indoors. So that's a local decision.
What does Dr. Fauci know that we don't know? Because he's wrong. Chicago does not have a mask mandate indoors for vaccinated people.
I think he's saying it under consideration, so on and so forth, whatever, the pronouncements. So let me just understand. So the CDC guidance, it's okay to not follow CDC guidance when it's in the direction of imposing strictures, regulations, lockdowns. But you're experimenting with human lives when you don't follow the CDC guidance in the direction of individual responsibility and freedom. CDC guidance. The guidance says you don't have to wear masks if you're indoors and vaccinated. But those communities that are imposing mask mandates, reimposing them, that's also consistent with CDC guidance. Oh, because there's discretion.
It's a clown show. The greatest show on earth.
Well, for more on this, put a tent over it. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Chad Savage, founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. Dr. Savage, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So what about Fauci and CDC and their guidelines?
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting. I just recently looked at their guidelines again because I've been intermittently doing that over the last year. And, you know, it's kind of run the gambit from don't wear them to wear them. And if you look and try to find out, you know, because one part of his interview was just this assumption or this, you know, that they work without really supporting why they came to that conclusion. And it's interesting the hypocrisy with which they treat the science on masks compared to how they treat the science and other treatment options for the COVID pandemic. And you know, the biggest study that's been done on masks is most relevant is the Danish study. And that's the only prospective, meaning that they assigned groups. They said, okay, these two groups of people, and they were large groups, over about 3,000 each, they say, okay, you wear masks, you don't wear masks, and they at the end, go live your lives normally, and then we're going to see if they actually did anything. And this study did not show a statistically significant advantage of wearing the masks. And the criticism that they had, they actually addressed it in one of their recent mask guidelines. They addressed it. The best study of its kind so far did not show a benefit. So they tried to discount it by saying, well, it only involved 0.1% of the entire Danish population, which is actually quite large. I mean, 0.1% of an entire country. I mean, a part of the concept of doing studies is that instead of doing the entire country being the study, is you take a small representative group, you do a study with them, and then you extrapolate the results to larger groups. So they say 0.1% of the entire Danish population is inadequate, but the very first study that they cite in support of mask use was two hairstylists in a salon. But apparently two people in a salon is a adequate sampling to prove that they work.
Well, they use that all the time, though, that, you know, that those two hairstylists saw 140 people, not one of them got sick.
Yeah, and then the other one, one of the others near the top of the list, was an individual family that they looked at, people who wore masks inside and the others. So again, two hairstylists, their customers, an individual family, but 0.1% of a population of an entire country is inadequate. And the other thing that they tend to do when it comes to therapeutics, when it comes to COVID, is they'll say, well, the claims of these various medications, and understand, I'm not saying whether ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which is clearly what I'm talking about, I'm not going to say whether they work or don't work. I'm just going to criticize the criticism. They say that the proposed benefits in some of the studies are so substantial that you have to draw their conclusions into question, which is, you know, normally in medicine, if we get a 20% reduction that in some negative outcome, that's actually considered pretty good. And some of these are supposing 70% reductions and things of that sort. So I get it. There should be a little appropriate skepticism of some of those findings. However, they don't turn around and then apply that same criterion to masks, which they immediately say masks reduce infection rate by 70% with no recognition of the hypocrisy of their statement, that they can apply it to the way that fits their predetermined narrative, but they don't apply the same criterion when it goes against that narrative.
And on masks, the subset that is most in discussion at present with the prospect of the school year starting again in a few weeks is kids. And here's what Yale epidemiologist Harvey Risch had to say about kids wearing masks in school. This was back in June.
It's damaging to the kids, and it's all theater. There's essentially no evidence that there's benefit for the kids or for the teachers. So, you know, I don't understand. There's been 12 now studies of masking. They essentially show null benefit in every one of those studies, and yet we're still somehow saying that masking has a benefit.
And that was in June, and here we are in August, and we're still talking. School districts are still wrangling with the issue of whether or not to impose mask mandates on kids when they return.
Yeah, and they always go to the single variant analysis. Even if they were correct and it reduced infection transmission, which is, I would argue, highly debatable, they don't look at any potential negative because there's just kind of a flippant disregard for any hesitation to use them and say, oh, you know, it's just a mask. What harm can it do? Yeah. But there's clear evidence that, you know, it does affect language development. It can affect clarity of speech and you know, people understanding facial recognition. And in these early stages of development, young children, CDC is now suggesting as low as 2 years of age, including the AAP, the Pediatric Association, down to 2 years of age should be wearing masks. Okay. Well, if they're wearing these masks, that is a fundamental developmental stage where they are learning how to interact with other human beings. And wearing masks does alter that. You can't see faces. You can't read lips if you have a hearing problem. It's not as though they're without consequence.
And then you have the AMA, American Medical Association Journal, they did an article about the carbon dioxide levels in children is so high that it's detrimental to them. Do you know more about that or anything about it?
Yeah, I know they retracted the study, so it's interesting. Any study that, again, goes against the narrative, talk about science, you could criticize it. You know, that's fine if you think that there's a flaw in it. But they can't even have that. They must stifle any dissent and pull it down. So they retracted it, and if you attempt to share it on Facebook, Facebook gives you a warning saying that they will they're going to, you know, limit the distribution of your Facebook posts because you shared what they call disinformation. Which is not disinformation, it's the results of their study. You can argue with the results of their study, but it's not disinformation, it's the information that they found. And that one was very interesting because they put a carbon dioxide sensor inside a mask and they record levels that were far in excess of what were considered safe levels of carbon dioxide exposure by OSHA work requirements. The criticisms of that study is that they feel that the sensor wasn't really good, and when you inspire, you take a deep breath in, you don't just get the air from within the mask, you get air from outside the mask too, so it's going to dilute that down. And then they said, well, they didn't do blood gas measures, meaning they didn't draw blood and actually measure how much it's actually affecting it within the bloodstream. Some of that's valid, but again, the massive hypocrisy that they apply extremely high levels of criticism to even have a study published versus extremely weak science that just happens to fit their narrative and goes not only unretracted but then widely distributed.
With the recent zeitgeist about the booster shot and the need to get the third jab, it was interesting to hear what BioNTech CEO Ugur Sahin had to say over the weekend. BioNTech developed the Pfizer vaccine with Pfizer, right? He said third shots rarely needed. Even as antibody levels dropping 7 months after the immunization among some vaccine recipients, most of them will remain protected against severe disease and probably not need a third dose, according to BioNTech CEO. He added the weakening of the first line of defense, the antibodies, meant that vaccinated people could get infected again, but there was no evidence that their cellular immunity was dropping since most infections wouldn't end in severe disease. So vaccine mandates to mandate or not to mandate with the vaccines generally, and now, you know, you're essentially getting competing opinions from similarly situated people about this need for a booster shot.
Yeah, and a lot of that goes back to the Delta variant. you know, and whether the vaccines work adequately. There's some evidence that they may be less effective against the Delta variant, and that the question is how much less effective. And there's a lot of discrepancy right now in that data. England and Israel are the two most prominent countries with the most data on the Delta variant. The English data from the Public Health England suggests that the vaccines are still 88% effective against the Delta, which would be exceedingly good. However, just over the weekend, Israel released some data suggesting that there may be a time dependence, which would support that there could be a waning of immunity over time, which is in conflict to Washington University, which recently released data suggesting that the vaccines may be effective for many years. But anyway, in the Israeli data, they said if you got the vaccine within the first couple of months of its distribution, the protection against the Delta variant could be as low as 16%, which it would be almost worthless. So that would suggest that repeated doses may be necessary. But the counter to that is, you know, first of all, will people even do it? This is not a benign vaccine in the sense that it causes no symptoms. Even if you discount, which I don't think you can, the risk of myocarditis, capillary leak syndrome, anaphylaxis, and the other negatives that can go along with the vaccine, it's a morbid vaccine. It makes people feel bad minimally. And if you told people, well, every 6 months you're going to have to take this vaccine that's going to lay up for a couple days, and we know with each successive dose that you tend to get more symptomatic, so you're going to feel worse and worse with every six-month shot, I don't think you're going to get a lot of compliance with that, mainly considering the mortality from this infection seems to be going down. So it may be becoming less dangerous to people. So case counts are one thing, but is it killing people is another. It still is. Don't get me wrong. I am not discounting that at all. But it appears to be becoming less dangerous over time. And if we develop effective therapeutics, which some people would argue we already have, and they likely are only going to become better over time, then I think this argument to repeatedly dose people, at least as the broad population, is a poor decision. The one exception may be the elderly. You know, if the most susceptible. I mean, I think you could make an argument that children don't need the vaccine at all. Previously infected people don't need the vaccine at all. It's supported by a study out of the Cleveland Clinic that showed that the reinfection rate was no difference between people who got the vaccine and people who had previously had the infection and survived it. So then you'd say, okay, kids don't need it. People previously infected don't need it. Well, then who needs a booster shot, if at all? And that would maybe be the high-risk elderly, which fits the Greater Barrington Declaration principle of protecting the vulnerable.
He is Dr. Chad Savage, that is founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute as well. Dr. Savage, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks again, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and intersection. Arrogance and ignorance. Intersection.
Yeah, and we got a new nickname for the Cleveland baseball team. No longer the Indians, of course. Maybe Lamont will go this way, too. Lamont High School will go with the Guardians the way the Cleveland baseball team is going with the Guardians. Some of the responses to this are pretty funny on Twitter. The Cleveland Guardians sounds like a crappy indoor soccer team no one watches. Yeah. Instead, it's a crappy baseball team that no one is going to watch. Hey. So does Cleveland still rock with the Guardians? Apologies to Drew Carey. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The Babylon Bee offering, the Cleveland Indians changed their name to the Cleveland Genderless Sports Players with no discernible racial features or specific ethnic background. It's better. It's more comprehensive,
or just
for sure.
Cleveland baseball.
Well, what about going the other way, since nicknames are pejorative? We understand now in the 21st century that, well, and frankly, the end of the 20th century, that nicknames don't honor a group of people. They ridicule a group of people, which is why you have to change Indians. That's the new understanding of nicknames. So why don't we ridicule people that deserve to be ridiculed? Right? So it could be like the Cleveland Honkies.
Oh, well, that's a little...
Right?
Yeah, I guess.
What about that? What about that in terms of, you know, helping to advance the purge by singling out groups who deserve to be ridiculed and marginalized for ridicule and marginalization? The Chicago Christians.
Instead of the Chicago Cubs?
Yeah, the Chicago Catholics, right? And then you could do that with other ethnicities under the umbrella of whiteness. Just a thought. Apparently, I take your suggestions if you have other nicknames, either along the lines of what I'm suggesting or maybe something that Cleveland didn't think about, or maybe something that the Washington football team can take up as they still
They haven't decided. They're not going to be the Warriors, though.
Apparently, the Guardians refers to Art Deco statues called the Guardians of Traffic, which grace the pylons at the Hope Memorial Bridge in central Cleveland. The Hope is for Bob Hope and his father. Bob Hope's father was one of the stonemasons who carved the Guardians of Traffic statues. Yeah. How about that?
Well, Guardians, Indians, they still have the same, you know, cursive. It's like play on words.
It's not a play on words. How is that a play
on
words?
No, I'm just saying the graphic looks a lot. It's the same graphic.
Oh, they have the same
cursive. Right, same cursive with a line underneath, but I'm saying
they have the same
Indians,
font.
Guardians, D-I-A-N-S is the same. I was thinking that might be one of the reasons why, or not.
Oh, it's
a stretch.
Not, apparently it's not, because there are these statues.
Right, the statues. Yeah. Back to Bob Hope.
Yeah. One sports writer in Cleveland at the Plain Dealer wanted to name the team the Cleveland Walleyes.
Oh.
I mean, you could do that after something, you know, celebrated, I don't know, whatever you pull out of the Cuyahoga River, but... but I don't know. I just think, like, let's lean into this notion, the premise of the left, that nicknames are ways to ridicule people. And so if they're ways to ridicule people or they're offensive, then we should have nicknames that offend people or ridicule people who deserve to be ridiculed. You see what I'm saying? Dan and Wilmette, you're on Chicago's
the
Morning
Chicago
Answer.
Unions.
So yeah, I think we should change the name of Chicago.
Yeah.
It comes from the Indian word meaning bad smell. And apparently we're ridiculing the Indians, making it sound like we're all killing people here all day.
Yeah. Well, what should we change the name Chicago to?
Slaughterhouse.
Probably. That's a good one.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dan. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. First off, kudos to Jason Benetti for realizing Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels were the Rockers. Two, Amy was right. It's a play on words because all the Indians have to do now is change the I and the N. And finally, for you, Mr. Prof, what's up for your white
not,
sock?
It's not a play on words, but okay, go ahead. Well, I'm glad that you're on the same wavelength as Amy. You should really reconsider that wavelength. But
hey, be nice, Richard.
Right.
And you better watch out for those white socks, because saying they're white implies white is some sort of supreme color.
Well, but this is what
but
I understand.
But then the Red Sox, too.
But I understand. If a nickname is ridicule, right, because Cleveland had to change the Indians because you're ridiculing the Indians. You're marginalizing the Indians. So if you're named the White Sox, how is that white supremacist? Wouldn't that be, if you want to make it about something other than actual socks that you wear, wouldn't that be ridiculing whiteness, right? I mean, because the Black Sox, can't say that, because that goes back to the scandal.
Right.
So what do you do? It's a real, conundrum.
I want to know how they got Tom Hanks to voice their commercial.
We are a city on the rise, forging into the future from our ironed-out past.
Don't.
We are a city of fire and water, of trees and towers, built through generations of blue collars and the brightest scholars, and all of those who have worked harder.
And then later he says, we are the Guardians. Dun, dun.
Well, he's not from Cleveland.
I know. That's why I was wondering why the heck they chose Tom Hanks to voice it.
What, Drew Carey wasn't available?
Well, exactly. They should have had a local.
Well, Drew Carey probably doesn't want to fly back from California. By the way, have you seen Drew Carey recently? I saw The Price is Right the other day.
Manorexic.
No.
Oh.
No, he's got a huge Santa beard.
Well, yeah, that's the COVID thing. Everyone's doing it. Girl, you had the party in the back for a while on your hairdo.
But I pulled it off. Drew Carey looks wrong. By the way, I was in Ohio this weekend. Lovely.
Oh.
Got to play the house that the Golden Bear built.
Which is what course?
Muirfield. In
Pardon?
Muirfield.
Okay.
Muirfield Village Golf Club. Top 15 course in the country. And they're in Dublin, I guess technically Dublin. It's not Columbus, technically Dublin.
Yeah. Well, fancy you. How'd you play? Did you represent?
Not great. No, it's very disappointing. I hate when I go to that's an experience, and don't play well, and I didn't play well.
I'm just worried that you're watching The Price is Right.
Well, I just saw it the other day because it comes on, I don't know, mid-morning.
Sure.
Having a cigar or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I was just thinking about that. What about the Cleveland Golden Bears? How about that after Jack Nicklaus? I mean, I know it's baseball and that's golf, but I don't know. But again, that violates my ridicule because nicknames don't honor somebody or some group. They ridicule. Maybe in the walleyes, couldn't be Cleveland walleyes because you don't want to ridicule a tasty fish. Sure.
Walleyes.
Yeah. By the way, Mike yes. Rose, who's a big-time developer in the area, was the guy who hosted me there. He's a great guy. You know how I know he's a great guy?
Because he hosted you there?
Exactly right.
Is that where you got your new shirt? Let me see.
Yeah.
Where's the logo?
Muirfield right there.
Wait. Oh, fancy you.
Yeah. I don't like to wear shirts of golf courses I haven't played.
Oh, because that you like you're a presumptuous wannabe.
Yeah. All right, I digress. Speaking of sports and politics and ignorance and arrogance. Suzanne in Mount Prospect.
Pleasantville.
Hi. I was just going to suggest the Cleveland Karens.
Karens.
Cleveland Karens. That's good.
Thanks for the call, Suzanne. And yeah, and then that has a, you know, sort of getting in touch with your feminine side.
Yeah.
Too. And your jag-off side simultaneously. Mike on the north side.
Boy, that's a heck of a segue, huh?
Yeah. Jag-off. Perfect segue.
Listen, Dan, you deserve to play at Muirfield. You're one of the top 15 morning radio hosts, AM Chicago Radio.
Exactly. Maybe.
There you go.
Maybe. Well, maybe.
If they're changing names, they got to get rid of White Sox and Cubs, especially White Sox. But, you know, Cubs, you know, it was named, they were picked by white people. So we have to go with what we have most in Chicago. We have at Comiskey Park, we'll have the Ghost Payrollers. And at Wrigley Field, we'll have the government freeloaders. All those millionaires getting their link cards for their groceries.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. I'm going to cut you off before you go on to Lee Ilya rant. Johnny and Kerry.
Hi. This is Johnny Bourgeois. You might remember me. I am of Polish descent.
Okay.
And I find the name White Sox deplorable, if you will, because when we were kids, this goes back a long time ago, if you wore white socks and hard shoes, you were called a Polack.
Oh, really?
And, of course, that was a derogatory term. Oh, yeah. Especially in Chicago.
Hmm. All right.
So,
I
get upset every time I see the White Sox.
Well, what should they change it to, then?
You know, that's a good question.
How about the
I think the last caller
about the,
had some...
How about the... for reparations for the offense that the White Sox name caused you and your fellow Poles, how about the Chicago Greg Luzinskis?
Now, there you go.
See?
I like that.
All right.
Or how about it goes back to the past, the Chicago Butchers?
Sure. Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Johnny. Appreciate it. Bill in Cape Coral.
Yeah, I think the Chicago Durbins, because they steal every base and they're foul and their salaries are way overpaid, their contracts for playing a game. Chicago Durbins.
Okay, thanks for the call, Bill. That's better, like, again, a nickname that is appropriate for ridicule. Yeah. Dave and Racine.
Yes, my thinking is various animal names of that are very adaptable. Like you got the coyotes, the raccoons, the crows, and the mourning doves. Maybe even the pit bulls.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. How about snow leopards, even though they're not indigenous to this area? Because
snow leopard. Oh, because one's got the vid.
Yeah, San Diego Zoo, a snow leopard got COVID. Snow leopard.
I mean, they're testing animals. The snow leopard had a little bit of a runny nose, and they tested it for COVID.
Shouldn't they mask up so that when grandma and grandpa take the kids to the zoo, the snow leopards don't kill grandma and grandpa?
If grandma and grandpa aren't vaccinated by this time, then that's their fault.
No, but I like
that. And they can suffer the repercussions because I'm so sick of this.
But that's going to be a celebrated animal, even more celebrated
right.
animal now because of
he's
the vid.
COVID survivor.
COVID survivor.
I survived COVID. Oh, my God. We're all going to die.
John and Crown Point.
We're going to die.
Yeah, forget the White Sox. We should rename the Cubs something befitting the Cubs and Chicago politicians, you know, the prosperity haters.
Okay. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but all right. Thanks for the call, John. I get the point. Elise in Rockton.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
You guys are forgetting the unsung heroes of today, the sheep. What about the white sheep?
Yeah.
The sheep.
The sheep.
Chicago white sheep. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. They're just the Chicago sheep.
All right. Yeah.
So right. Everyone's just going along to get along. Yes, sir. May I have another? Thank you.
Thanks for the call,
Mask
Elise.
Me up. I'm worried. The TV reporters telling me that cases have tripled. Well, yeah, if you go from 0.4 to 1.5, they've almost quadrupled.
Chicago COVIDians.
Yeah. Oh, the Chicago COVIDians. Chicago COVID enthusiasts.
Yeah.
COVIDians is better because it is a cult right now.
Joe and Racine.
Dear Lord, help
us. Hi, guys. Love your show. Hey, last night watching the Brewers and White Sox, at the half inning, they referred to the White Sox as the pale hose.
Yes.
The what?
And I never heard that before.
You never heard pale hose before?
I've never heard pale hose before.
Never.
Yeah.
What's this?
Not referring to the White Sox, but.
Oh, but then, referring to what? Huh? What, Linkin Park Trixies? What are you talking about?
Well, I didn't grow up in Chicago. So oh, all right.
No, pale hose, White Sox, right? Yeah. Not,
yeah,
not,
I get it, but
yeah, it's not hose in the, you know, street vernacular.
Oh yeah. No,
yeah,
exactly. I didn't go there either. So.
Okay, all right. Thanks for the thanks,
care, guys.
Joe. Oh no, we just had this nice talk with Johnny, and Chet is going to ruin it. Chet on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Come on, no.
Hey, I'm Polish, you guys know that. I'm up in the Upper Peninsula now, but my family had to leave Chicagoland in 1981. We were afraid of Mount Prospect erupting.
That's a pretty good local Polish joke. Thanks
Thank
for the
you.
Call, Chet. That's good.
That is good.
There was a nudist colony there.
Yeah, there was. In my house that we moved into on Moki.
And joined it.
915 Moki Lane. It's right there. They took all the trees out, though. So you can't hang out naked.
Well, they had Mr. T over there?
No, the guy that lived in our house put mirrors in every room. He was a nudist, and he had things. People,
like to admire himself, sure.
Yeah, but he also had 39 trees in the backyard and then three huge pine trees in the front yard so he could walk around nude.
And he would have people.
No, I live next door to the Krauses, and they remember. The dude was crazy.
So he had
lots of cats. He lived with his mother.
Uh-huh.
And
is she also naked?
I don't know what happened to her. But he would walk around. That's why he put all these trees in, so that he could walk around the backyard naked.
Maybe it's something
the
has
people
to do with
saw
that.
Him.
Maybe it has something to do with the house then.
It's not
your
the house.
Your condition. I mean,
what about cats? How I love cats.
Yeah, that also that. Yeah.
My condition.
Robert and Schomburg.
Yeah, how about the White Sox? The Chicago Zebras.
Why? Why?
Why?
Chicago White Sox, now call them the Chicago Zebras.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Okay. Well, this
repeats
is a good
it for
one.
Emphasis. Steve in Northwest Indiana.
Speaking of cats, the Chicago Kitty Cats.
Meow, meow.
Okay.
Ron Kittle.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Kitty
yeah.
Cat, of course.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. All right. Thanks for and he's still a local, too.
Right. You should follow him on Twitter and Facebook. He's good.
I just follow the Iron Sheik, so that's my one new follow
Iron
for
Sheik.
This year. Yeah, from WWF days.
Oh.
Yeah. He's hilarious. Oh. Michael in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Ready for this? They don't even have to change the hat. The Cleveland Capitulates.
thanks for the call, Mike, or the quality of play, generally speaking, too. Also, the NFL, too. This is interesting because what the NFL is doing is what I think is happening to so many people in their workplace. No mandate, just like, you know, just like the White House. There's no vaccine mandate. But here's what they're doing. If a game is canceled or postponed because a club cannot play due to a COVID spike among or resulting from its non-vaccinated players and staff, then the burden of the cancellation or delay will fall on the club experiencing the COVID infection. If it can't play, then potentially it has to, you know, can't play at the prescribed time, it then potentially has to forfeit. The team would have to forfeit. Really interesting because it's, you know, again, it's a way to have team owners, front offices, put pressure on the players to get vaccinated. And there's a lot of resistance from NFL players, some high profile, to get vaccinated. For example, DeAndre Hopkins, who is an outstanding wide receiver for the Cardinals, he threatened to retire rather than getting the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting because all this talk about now it's just a pandemic among the unvaccinated. We talked about this a bit last week. And you see the coverage continues. And it's red states. It's red states that are seeing the spike. Okay. Break that down within those red states. Because we know demographically, along racial lines, nationally, that whites have a greater percentage of whites are vaccinated than Latinos and a greater percentage of Latinos than blacks. So now what do you say? What are you going to virtue shame black athletes like DeAndre Hopkins or black Americans, generally speaking, who are behind in terms of their, you know, per capita vaccination rate? You know, what's a identitarian leftist to do?
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Adam Kinzinger, tapped by Nancy Pelosi to serve on her 1-6 kangaroo court.
Oh, yeah. And she says it's going to be a bipartisan commission, you know, with Liz Cheney and now Adam Kinzinger.
We will find the truth. That truth will have the confidence of the American people because it will be done patriotically and not in a partisan way.
No, of course, it's going to set us free. Here's what Kinzinger said. For months, we have searched for answers and what process we should use to get them. For months, lies and conspiracy theories have been spread, threatening our self-governance. For months, I've said the American people deserve transparency and truth on how and why thousands showed up to attack our democracy and ultimately what led to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol complex on January 6th. Self-governance requires accountability and responsibility. My faith requires the same of me. Truth is necessary for order, and that's what I will do. Let me be clear. I'm a Republican dedicated to conservative values, but I swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And while this is not the position I expected to be in or sought, when duty calls, I will always answer. That is very heroic and patriotic, isn't it?
Go, Adam, go.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It is quite an honor for Kinzinger because, as you heard from Nancy Pelosi, and as everyone already knows, Pelosi values Republican assistance, particularly in politically charged matters, to aid her search for the truth and help guide even-handed determinations on the merits. That's Nancy Pelosi's calling card. And now Adam Kinzinger has a chance to facilitate that search for the truth and the determination that should be made in terms of any action to be taken after that truth is obtained. Isn't that wonderful?
Starts tomorrow, folks. Must watch TV, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to watch that? That or the Olympics? I don't know. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line.
Well, where is where's Kinzinger on the topic of Tucker Carlson being unmasked by NSA after apparently some communications of his were caught up in you know, the routine domestic surveillance they don't do, according to Jim Clapper. Any concern about that? Concern about the treatment of Tom Barrack in comparison to, say, Hunter Biden? Tom Barrack, inaugural chairman, he's a billionaire, real estate guy, friend of Trump's, inaugural committee chairman for Trump. He's been indicted for failing to disclose lobbying on behalf of a foreign government, United Arab Emirates, $250 million bond.
Oh, my God.
Any concern?
Mass murderers don't get that.
The search for truth, Representative Kinzinger, the search for truth, any interest in the Durham report that allegedly is going to be made public, according to some flunky at Merrick Garland's Department of Justice, if and when it's ever completed? Any concern about that? No. What about the stories about the FBI's involvement in the Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot? Any concern about that? As part of the 1-6 Commission, since we've had stories about the FBI's involvement, use of informants, what did they know, when did they know it, who did they communicate what they knew to, when, is that going to be part of your robust truth commission, you and Nancy Pelosi in your search for truth? Greg and LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, guys. Edmund Kinzinger is nothing but a political grifter. The fact that him and Liz Cheney are on this commission is perfect because it's going to fail. It's going to be an epic fail by Pelosi. I'm glad the two Jims, one from Indiana, one from Ohio,
right,
are not on this commission, because I think it would only give the Democrats fodder. Adam Kinzinger stands up for nothing except Adam Kinzinger. He's an opportunist. That's it. He's a political grifter. He'll never be anything more. And everybody sees through him because he will never tackle the hard question, because he's not strong enough to. He deserves Illinois, and Illinois deserves him if they reelect this guy.
Thanks for the call, Greg. I remember when Adam Kinzinger would come on a show, on this show. Now he just it goes on CNN to be fawned over by Don Lemon and Anderson Cooper and the gang. Yeah, big tough guy. Mm-hmm. He's standing and delivering the truth in the face of any opposition. He's not. I'm sorry to say it, because I personally liked him, got along well with him. But I mean, people's conduct is what matters, and the representation you provide is what matters. And he's decided to turn his back on most things that make sense.
I mean, and for Nancy Pelosi saying this is not a partisan group, the two Republicans both voted to impeach Trump.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Well, not of course, but I mean, you're doing the bidding of Nancy Pelosi. I mean, what are you talking about? Of course it's a kangaroo committee. Of course it's a star chamber proceeding. I mean, these are people who still won't disavow the Russian collusion allegations that were made. Sans any evidence. And as I said, have no concern, at least none stated, no rolling concern, about the abuses that have been identified, not by me, not by conservatives, by, for example, like the Department of Justice Inspector General. No concern about any reckoning there. Don't hear any discussion of that. But when it comes to the opportunity to take pot shots at Trump and Trump supporters, you can always find those never Trumpers fascinating. Now, any comment on the Lincoln Project and that Predator co-founder, John Weaver, and all of these self-dealing consultants that didn't do anything and had zero impact, but just make hysterical statements on those same places with those same news readers, talking points purveyors, about 1-6 was worse than 9/11, 1-6 Civil War? No. Oh, and you know how Trump was so gauche and pimply and he violated all these norms, and now the norms have been reestablished because we have a decent man in the White House. Oh, he's decent. Oh, yeah, decent man. Again, look at his conduct, not his tone. And I don't like the way Trump behaved many times, and I don't like the rhetorical choices he made many times. But, I mean, all of this, everything was so buttoned down and by the book and decent people learning how to get along and trying to solve problems. This is what we're supposed to believe American politics was pre-Trump, and that is the big lie. That is the big lie. I mean, can we go back to LBJ? I was just thinking about this the other day when I heard somebody prattling on about norms and respect to the office and stuff. LBJ used to walk around trying to intimidate people, not just by getting in their personal space, but also by referencing his penis, which he called Jumbo. And
how you doing down there, Jumbo?
He would always be digging around for it. I mean, you know.
And take crap. Oh, go to the bathroom in front of people. And I mean, he was disgusting.
He was crass, like Trump is often. But everything was this sort of utopian representative republic, nice and tidy, with decent please clap Republicans like George W. Bush. And then we had somebody that decided to bring a bicycle chain to the playground. It's pathetic. And again, this is very much like the conversation about, I mean, not McCain, because McCain was a real war hero, but very much like the conversation about anybody who served. Hey, I appreciate the military service, respect that, but it doesn't give you a free pass for the rest of your life and everything you do, including as a public official. Robert in Marcellus.
Hey, you're talking about my congressman, Adam Kingslayer.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, well, you know, he got my vote last time because he ran against a socialist lady. Next time I'm voting for the socialists, at least I know what I'm getting.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is 60 Seconds of Sanity with Dan Proft. The timer starts now.
Dr. Murphy's Truth Ministry, in his majority opinion in the 1943 case of West Virginia v. Barnett, Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson wrote, "Compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. It stands as one of the great holdings in First Amendment jurisprudence." The Biden administration has taken the opposite view, that only through the elimination of dissent can we truly be free. Thus, the rollout of the Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy's Truth Ministry. The same social media platforms that banned a certain former president of the United States aren't doing enough to quash cognitive dissonance on COVID, says Minister Murthy. Misinformation must be banned to save lives, they say. What constitutes misinformation? Who decides? Any statement that doesn't come from a credible source, they say. Which are the credible sources? Who decides? We get no answers to questions that would define the parameters of legitimate thought because Dr. Murthy's Ministry of Truth isn't interested in winning an argument or even making one, but rather only in enforcing an opinion. And to the graveyard goes a free society.
That was beautiful.
Thank you very much.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. How about these protests, anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine mandate protests around the world over the weekend, from Paris to Israel?
Australia, they had a huge one there.
Germany. You can understand why Australia might be tiring of these. Half the country right now in Australia, as I understand it from the reporting, is on strict lockdown after 82,000 tests turned up 111 new cases.
And they're not hospitalizations, and deaths are at the lowest they've ever been. People are losing their minds. My friend in Germany went to visit his mother's grave because she died during COVID. Dan, they wouldn't let him go and put flowers on his mother's grave because he didn't have a negative test with him and he didn't have a vaccination card. And it's an outdoor, it's a cemetery.
That's why people are protesting in Germany, too. I mean, it's, people are out of their minds.
Well, and in Paris, government officials, Macron and others, decreeing unvaccinated individuals will not be allowed to enter cafes, restaurants, theaters, public transportation, and more. So that is why people were a little bit annoyed by that new declaration. I mean, it's all over the world. By the way, Sweden, which is a catastrophe, has daily COVID deaths of zero.
Exactly. They did it right. And Lollapalooza starts this Thursday, and you're supposed to be vaccinated or show that you have a negative test. And nobody can answer how they're going to check that. Nobody knows.
Maybe this is...
we've reached out to them, like, how is that going to go down? Are you going to have somebody there when you have thousands of people coming in at the same time and you want to get them through? You're going to, okay, I want to see how this is going to work.
Maybe this is why people are getting increasingly pessimistic about the direction of the country, even coming out of a lockdown and a pandemic. It's sort of remarkable. I think there's some COVID exhaustion, but not with respect to the COVIDians. They're never exhausted when power is on the line. For more on this and a couple other topics, please be joined again by David Harsanyi, Senior Writer for National Review, author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you see the unrest around the globe, as we were discussing. Here it's less pronounced, but and the lockdown redux policies less draconian, perhaps. Though, again, over the weekend you had... Tony Fauci, along with Jake Tapper, doing their Rowan and Martin routine, talking about mask wearing, where the CDC doesn't recommend, where they're in talks to potentially recommend masks indoors for vaccinated people, but they don't currently. But they're also okay with L.A. County requiring masks for people who are vaccinated indoors as well. So I guess for the reasonable person just trying to make their way in this country, it's got to be pretty frustrating. It is for me.
Right. But I was a little taken aback this weekend because I don't think that most people, at least where I live in the D.C. area, are reasonable. You have kids on their bicycles outside in 90-degree weather with masks on. I mean, yep. It's like child abuse. And I just can't even believe how many people will still wear them for no real scientific reason, supermarkets and elsewhere. It's not the same, I'm sure, everywhere in the country, but in sort of liberal urban areas, I think it's pretty bad.
Oh, it's bad here in Chicago. People wearing bathing suits while they're running through a sprinkler. So the mask is soaking wet and now it's being sucked to their face. And I don't know any parents. I haven't seen any reasonable parents who let their kids be unmasked outside in the heat when it's 92 degrees. I don't understand this. If they just talk to their pediatrician will tell them, or they should tell them, that it doesn't matter. They're not the health risk that we thought that they were.
Yeah. How many kids have been seriously hospitalized or died from COVID in the whole time, maybe 300, I think it was under 18. But I mean, you're talking about a minuscule number of kids, maybe. There's just no reason for it. There's rational or scientific reason.
They all had comorbidities. Who do we have on last week that said, ask any doctor, has a healthy child in this world died from COVID? And he'll say no.
Meanwhile, across the pond in the UK, a study out last week, University of College London, University of York, University of Liverpool, University of Bristol, 5 times more children committed suicide than died of COVID-19 during the lockdown in England. And, of course, we know the increase in both drug overdoses and suicides among young people last year in this country as well. So now we're finally getting back to the lives versus lives. But it's remarkable to me. It's sad, actually. The myopia that people have had for the last year until the data comes in. Like, you know, anecdotes about COVID is fine and we should make policy based on whoever's most frightened about the anecdotes they hear. But the concern about the impacts, however correlative as opposed to, you know, causative with respect to the lockdown policies and mental health and destructive behavior, you know, that wasn't really something that was legitimate to talk about until this spring.
Yeah, I know. You know, and then Facebook would ban you if you talked about where COVID came from, et cetera. This is not science. It strips us of the ability to debate things rationally, even vaccines. You know, listen, I'm pro-vaccine. I have vaccine. I want people to take it. But why can't we talk about what perhaps side effects might be or whatever? It's just it's insanity. It's a problem when it comes to free speech. It's a problem when it comes to just rationally living your lives. I think lockdown protests are probably this, widespread because they didn't work. I mean, I think all the evidence shows that they really weren't very effective as far as saving lives, but they were effective in destroying economies, and there's just no reason to go back to that.
Well, and the other thing about the vaccines and those promoting mandates and promoting sort of COVID apartheid for the unvaccinated, you have the White House announcing that they don't have a vaccine mandate for White House staff. And so you're a bad person if you don't get vaccinated, according to so many of the TV doctors and pundits. But the White House gets a pass for imposing a mandate.
Right. And then they do in these stories about people who are, some people have conspiracy theories, some people have rational reasons not to do it, but they conflate also people who are against mandates, which I am on COVID vaccines. Listen, I think at some point in the world, you say, if you don't want to take a vaccine, that's on you. And if you get sick, that's on you. And I go on with my life. There's really no, I think that's the American way, right? I mean, we can't force people to take medicines they don't want to take.
No. We're all in this together. We're all in this together, Dave. We're all in the same boat.
I hate when people say that. I'm definitely not in this together with most people. I mean, I'm in it with my community, some of the people in my family, et cetera. I do not like this. It's the same thing with the unity, you know, that Barack Obama sort of brought that forward. I think that what's great about America is that we don't have to believe the same things at lockstep in the same way. But I guess that's a different topic.
Now, you tweeted recently a comment or referred to a tweet from the ACLU about racism is foundational in the Second Amendment.
Yeah. So there's a new book out called The Second, which makes the case. It's sort of the 1619ing of the Second Amendment, where it essentially claims that gun rights are predicated or were written and contingent on the Southern states being able to, or help the Southern states being able to deal with slaves. You know, so that's why they gave the right to gun ownership to white Americans, which is preposterous since white Southerners had guns before and had put down slave revolts. It's not as if they needed to ask for permission. But moreover, this woman, Carol Brower, is it? I forget her name, but she contends that James Madison had written the Second Amendment in essence to help ease the way for the Southern states to join the Union. There is no evidence there. I wrote a long piece in the National Review. People can read it where I lay out the evidence. The Second Amendment was part of American life, in essence, from the beginning. It goes back to British common law. Self-defense is a right that almost any British person anywhere in the empire would have understood and had nothing to do with slavery. And it's not to say slavery didn't exist, not to say that people didn't abuse it. Their rights to gun ownership, obviously. But the real problem with the Second Amendment is that it didn't offer Black Americans and slaves the right to defend themselves as well. Not that they were just given to, you know, just that it was written down. Does it make any sense?
Well, right. And now today, I mean, like this, it's interesting that they're taking up this issue. I mean, against the backdrop of groups like Black Guns Matter, our friend Maj Teray's group out of Philadelphia, and just the where the law stands, thanks to Supreme Court decisions in the 50 states. But yet at the time, this book you mentioned and sort of this identitarian perspective on the Second Amendment, John Paul Stevens's op-ed about repealing the Second Amendment, year and a half ago. And Biden last week at that ghastly CNN town hall where he's bumbling around talking about I want to ban everything, but I can't ban everything. So we're going to try and ban some things. I mean, it's just one of those things where it seems like for the left, it's a box check. But there's not much more behind. I mean, and I don't mean to be flippant about it or fail to be circumspect about their real interests. But in terms of what they can reasonably do, it seems like it's just something for a CNN town hall and not much more.
Well, yeah, they can't do much now. I mean, you're right. There's a sort of identitarian revisionist history now in all things, right? So this is just part of that. But it is important to note that almost every gun control law in the early republic, or even throughout the 19th century and the early 20th century, were racist purpose, right? They were, after the Civil War, the first gun control gun control laws in the South were about denying black people guns, and so on. It went on and on until the 60s. So that's the real history of gun control in America. And you're right about the incrementalism they're into. At least Biden basically admitted that, listen, it's just about banning what we can. AR-15s are not part of most criminality. They want to ban it because it's about incrementally moving towards banning other sorts of guns. It's a heavy lift for many reasons. The law, for first, the Constitution, but also because so many people have weapons, you actually physically have to take it from them. And that's not easy. And it's not easy on purpose. I mean, that's why the Second Amendment exists.
With respect to law enforcement, you know, it's not a binary. We often have to have this conversation when we're talking about a police-involved shooting. And when we're talking about the FBI these days, and I wanted to get your reaction to the assertions made in court documents about the FBI's involvement in the Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping plot. And again, if what BuzzFeed reported is true, I mean, it's more than just a case of entrapment. There's something, it seems to me, at least a conversation about something culturally wrong in the FBI that extends beyond the senior leadership.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I was pretty suspicious about this when it happened. I saw one of the people involved were supposedly members of Black Lives Matter, and it was just a weird situation. But anyway, I think the FBI has been doing this for a long time in different ways. I can remember a case, don't exactly know what year it was, but a while ago, where there was a terror cell, I think it was in New York, and it turned out, you know, there was one teenager, basically, and like six people involved in the plot, and the six had all been, part of the FBI, and they kind of like baited this kid into, and it's not okay, right? It's not okay to involve yourself in something like that, but it's clearly the FBI not looking for criminals, but creating criminals. And that's a problem. I don't know how deep it goes, but obviously this is another case of that.
And the Tucker Carlson story, too. I mean, Tucker Carlson made this assertion on his show the end of last month about somebody at NSA telling him that the people there reading his emails. He repeated back to Tucker stuff that I guess you could have only known if you had read his emails. And it turns out this pertained to him trying to get Vlad Putin on his show. And now the NSA said, you know, we're not targeting Tucker Carlson. We're not trying to take him off the air. But he was unmasked. So some official with that sort of clearance moved to unmask him for some reason. And of course, NSA is not going to say why, because, well, we're, you know, as part of our foreign surveillance, this was folded in. There was an unmasking done, and you know, to get context, which is what the same thing they used during the Russian collusion imbroglio that still is unresolved. And so, you know, how are we to understand the Tucker Carlson getting caught up in the NSA's net when other networks that have actually interviewed Vlad Putin apparently have not been caught in that same net?
I mean, it's to some extent, I mean, it's mind blowing that journalists get into the, you know, they argue over semantics. They're like, it's, you know, they make excuses, rationalize, justify this kind of spying. And that's what it is. He's an American citizen. Someone unmasked him. And then someone leaked what was said. Every journalist should be just outraged that happens. And they aren't, because it's Tucker Carlson. So if obviously I hate formulating this in this way, but I'd have to, if Donald Trump had done this to, you know, Jim Acosta or something, that we would have a national meltdown right now. But it's okay. It happened in the Russian thing as well. You know, they just were manufacturing warrants. They were lying on them. They were spying on Americans. They were using it for political ends. It is just a huge abuse of power, and no one does anything about it because they're aiming at they're fired at the right people.
David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review. The book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, from the Revolution to Today. David, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thanks, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
60 seconds. Total madness. This is 60 Seconds of Crazy with Amy J.
Let's do 30.
Oh, you're so rude. I'll give you 10. Curtis Sliwa, you know, he's running for governor. Excuse me, mayor of New York. We've had him on, you know, as a Republican. And we learned the other day.
Guardian angel, Curtis Sliwa.
Yeah, you know Curtis Sliwa. We learned when he called in that he doesn't have a few cats. He has 16 cats in his small New York City apartment, rescue cats. And for his wife's birthday, he got her. Guess what? He got her. A cat.
Number 17.
Oh, what a great birthday for my beautiful wife, Nancy. And in advance of the birthday, Nancy rescued this 10-year-old cat who's only 4 pounds and blind. And we need a name for this cat because we've run through about 50 names of different cats that we have adopted.
How about Papillon?
Papillon.
Yeah.
So he tweeted that out. Yeah, it's a birthday gift to his wife. At least he's married and she's along with this, you know,
he's
with
a
the rescue.
Nice
the
guy, and that's wonderful. But any more than two cats is disqualifying for high office.
Especially in a tiny New York apartment. Whew.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Uh-oh. Nancy Pelosi may have disrupted a deal between Please Clap Republicans and the Biden White House on $1 trillion in funny money spending on infrastructure. She wants to push everything through the tax and spend bonanza of reconciliation. And Senator Rob Portman, outgoing senator from Ohio, Mr. Charisma, was on this week with Clinton Foundation Donor Zero and said this.
Well, George, let me say that what she has just said is entirely counter to what President Biden has committed to and what the Senate is doing, which is a two-track process. The infrastructure bill has nothing to do with the reckless tax and spend extravaganza that she's talking about in terms of what reconciliation, as she called it. So no, I'm not happy with what she said because it's inconsistent with the agreement that we have on a bipartisan basis.
Does that mean we'll end up with nothing?
Go on their own. Well, if she has her way, we could. I'm not sure what the future is of reconciliation. I know that the bipartisan infrastructure package is very popular among the American people and in the United States Congress because it makes sense. We need it badly. You know, 43% of our roads are in bad or mediocre condition, according to the engineers. 46,000 bridges are structurally deficient. We have ships lining up at ports because our ports aren't efficient enough. 87% of the American people think we should do a bipartisan infrastructure package. It's the right thing to do.
It's the right thing to do. I know that's the popular opinion, but is he right? Well, let's put that question to John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of When Politicians Panicked. I think you can guess what the topic of that book is. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
How about Rob Portman and the Please Clap Republicans and their $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal? Good thing?
Well, oh, no, of course it's not a good thing. It's inevitable. What did Ronald Reagan discover when he was president? That it's very hard to shrink government because everyone's got something, at least one thing they want to spend money on. So ultimately they all vote for each other. I suppose this is good in the compromise sense. Let's be optimistic in the compromise sense in that Biden was talking $6 trillion not too long ago. He was completely delusional. A divided Congress could never get something like that through. So let's cheer Republicans for somewhat acting like Republicans, although I feel like they're less obstructionist than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the good news front, because I know you're an optimist by disposition, much more so than me, so I'm trying to get on your vibe here. Word over the weekend, a record dollar amount of money worldwide funneled into U.S. Financial assets, more than $900 billion into U.S. domicile mutual and exchange traded funds. That's a record going back to 1992. So the world is betting on America.
Yeah. Can you blame them? We make mistakes. We make gargantuan ones, but we're still arguably the freest people on earth. We're the most talented people on earth. People around the world, if given a choice, would migrate to the U.S. in a heartbeat. And why would they? Because they know that this is where they can most achieve their economic specialty, what makes them unique in the marketplace. Could we improve? Obviously, we can. We've been talking about this for a while, but where are you going to put your money in a world in the world? The United States is still the place to be.
And the United States is the place to be, like in the markets or like in real assets? Because I know, and you wrote about this, that Jay Powell says that inflation is transitory, and he says so because he said so.
Well, it's a very good question. Certainly some people, you know how Americans diversify their investments across companies and across countries. Certainly people around the world do the same thing. Some like to basically park their wealth in real assets, housing in the United States. The Chinese, for instance, are notorious for doing this. Hard to blame them for wanting to diversify. Inflation, there's no doubt when there's periods of immense interest in the housing market, which is consumption. Consumption is not, housing's not an investment, it's just consumption. That's a signal of market uncertainty about the value of the dollar. That's why housing did so well in the 70s. That's why it did so well in the 2000s. The dollar is weak right now. It's been weak for a while. That is a concern. That is the inflationary signal, not rising prices for cars and everything. That, by definition, is transitory.
And what about the Biden administration policies? So some of these policies that could certainly retard the recovery and growth in the future. And one of them is energy and energy policy. So at the same time, they're moving to end land leases for oil exploration. They're pushing OPEC to increase production, which doesn't seem to make much sense from a national security or an economic perspective. But fossil fuels, still 81% of our energy comes from fossil fuels, and that's not going to change materially in the near future. It's just a question of where those fossil fuels come from. But do you have any concern that the pipeline decisions, the land lease decisions, the outsourcing to OPEC or oil production will have a real, measurable, demonstrable negative impact on growth?
I'm always concerned when presidents want to intervene, but ask yourself the question, when was the oil industry in the United States most on its back in modern times? The answer is very simple, the Reagan years and the Clinton years. You see, we had a good dollar during those years, and so the price of oil, it had been very high in the 70s when we devalued, it plummeted in the 80s and 90s. And so we basically didn't have an energy industry. Was that a national security risk? No, not at all. It doesn't matter where the oil is produced. We could be 100% bereft of oil in the United States and embargoed by every oil-producing company and country on earth and at war with them, and we'd still consume their oil as though it bubbled up in West Texas. You can't account for the final destination of any good. So this modern obsession on the right about being energy independent is so backwards, and it's so economically crippling. Oil is something that Equatorial Guinea can do, that Saudi Arabia can do, that Russia, Venezuela can do, that Nigeria can do, some of the most backward countries on earth. And so is it any surprise that during periods when the U.S. is producing lots of oil, that these are periods of subpar economic growth relative to the 80s and 90s? No, because we're suddenly not employing comparative advantage. We're basically competing in a space that some of the lamest countries on earth can compete with us with instead of doing what no one can do.
Well, but I mean, I think the issue is the comparative advantage argument is a fair point. But I think the issue is when you have government intervene, as you mentioned at the outset, and skew the marketplace. I mean, that's not what we want. I mean, why wouldn't we want to be a net exporter of oil rather than a net importer?
Why don't we be a net exporter of bananas and shoes and televisions, too? I mean, I suppose we could. We get a paperclips also. We would be very poor. It doesn't matter where something's produced. And certainly it doesn't matter with oil. Oil is a signal that we're moving backwards, not forwards. Again, it's something that some of the poorest, lamest, most backwards countries on the earth can easily source. And let's keep in mind, the biggest market intervention that causes us to be big players in oil has been the devaluation of the dollar. Do you think that we'd be fracking today? Do you think that you'd have ever heard of fracking if George W. Bush doesn't substantially devalue the dollar in the 2000s? Because let's be clear about something. As Harold Hamm, the most notorious fracker in the world, will tell you, you can't get oil out of the ground profitably with fracking unless oil is above $50 a barrel. So basically, every American has to suffer a weaker dollar, a weaker economy, reduced economic opportunities so that we can be powerful in oil. I mean, where's the growth in that?
Well,
because
we couldn't frack
in the 80s and 90s. Why couldn't we? Because there was no, at $10 a barrel, when Americans were paying $1 a gallon instead of $4 a gallon. So basically the poorest people weren't having their paychecks eviscerated by weak dollar policy. Yeah, we weren't big in the oil business, but no one cared. They were just much better off economically.
Well, I agree. Obviously, the idea of a competitive marketplace where you're driving the prices down, you know, looking at things through the eye of the consumer, and that would necessarily include commodities, I agree with. But I'm just saying, sort of like when you know, unfortunately, the way we talk about energy policy is always involves government and government somehow rigging the system in one direction or the other, as opposed to a true marketplace. And then I think your argument holds up. But when I think, just to be clear, when people say we're not moving forward, it, you know, it sounds like alternative energy and things like that. Well, alternative energies, it's fine as long as they're sustainable under their own weight, but not the incentives for windmills and switchgrass and solar like we have now.
No doubt, but let's be clear, oil's not sustainable under its own weight in the U.S., at least exploration, without a severely devalued dollar. And I think you hit on the crucial point. Governments are always intervening in this. And what does that tell you? It's kind of a sclerotic business in the first place. Most of the oil around the world is essentially owned by government. It still flows. But software and technology, this is not. That's not to say that fracking isn't impressive technology. But let's remember, it doesn't make economic sense without a severely debased dollar that pushes up the price of oil very artificially. So look, Biden's intervention, okay, totally clueless. But the right wing's obsession with energy independence, we want to be Saudi American, source our own oil, is every bit as economically bankrupt and stupid and has nothing to do with national security, given the basic truth that if you're being productive, you are always the receiver of goods from around the world. Let's remember, during World War I, suddenly U.S. trade with the Scandinavian countries surged. Well, why was that? Because we were still trading with Germany, but just around the embargo. In the 1970s, the Arab oil embargo didn't cause prices to rise. What happened was we devalued the dollar, and commodities across the board rose. There's no way that OPEC can keep oil from us. So this notion that it could actually cut us off defies basic economics. It vandalizes basic economics.
I was just on the issue of the devaluation of the dollar. I was having this discussion over the weekend with some sophisticated guys. And the question is whether or not in our lifetime we could see a threat to the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, most notably from the yuan.
Right now, it's the yuan's 2%. The dollar is about 70% of all global transactions. So it's hard to imagine now, but things change. To me, I think the biggest savior for the dollar is the yuan, because it's going to force, ideally, the U.S. Treasury to get more serious about issuing a currency that people can trust around the world. Why is the dollar the world's currency? Because for all its demerits, it's broadly trusted. And the yuan is only going to force us to be better. I would add that cryptocurrencies are another source of competition that are going to force the U.S. Treasury to get real about the dollar. Historically, we never even talked about dollar policy because the dollar was defined as 1/35th of an ounce of gold, and the world was on a dollar standard. But in modern times, we've chosen to be stupid. We've decided to step backwards and pretend that money is anything other than a measure. And so we're actually having these conversations. But ultimately, the currency that's most trusted is the world's currency. And so hopefully the competition from China will actually improve the dollar.
He is John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of the book, When Politicians Panicked. John, thanks as always for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, I'm dying.
Dan and Amy, here's a story that shock jock Paul Vallis wouldn't do. I'll tell you that right now. Once the FBI is done helping a couple of goofballs plot the kidnapping of the governor of Michigan, they can perhaps devote more resources to this guy. There's a man calling across random libraries throughout the country asking for information on a court case, specifically Brady v. Maryland. And when he calls the library, he claims he doesn't have a computer, so he asks for the case to be read aloud to him.
Okay.
He's called multiple libraries, when you start reading to him, he begins to pleasure himself. He's called multiple libraries, done this. FBI is supposedly involved, can't catch this pervert that's just calling libraries and getting off on librarians reading about Brady v. Maryland, which is an important case.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what's sexy about it?
Brady v. Maryland was a case in which the Supreme Court held that prosecutors have to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense.
Oh, it's so sexy. Where do I touch myself first?
Exculpatory.
Oh.
Yeah. So apparently he's...
you can find the sexy right there. Oh, yeah. You just did. You naughty person, you.
Favorite Supreme Court case to masturbate to? By the way, I hope Jeffrey Toobin has an alibi here since they have not identified this guy. Give it to me. Give me that exculpatory evidence. Spank those prosecutors. It is apparently something he said, or maybe somebody imagined he would be saying. Your favorite case to pleasure yourself to?
I'm going to sit this one out, but I want to ask you what your favorite case is.
Probably Marbury versus Madison. You know, John Marshall, judicial review. I mean, that's hot.
Oh, it's...
That is hot. Can't keep my hands off myself.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.